Thank you. Are you ready? Okay, great. So I want to thank you all for joining us today. My name is Jessica Weider, as I said. I'm with EPA's Radiation Protection Program. I'm here with Brian Littleton of EPA's Radiation Protection Program as well, and he will give us a presentation on the Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, which is an ANP, called ANPR for short, for EPA's Environmental Protection Standards for Nuclear Power Operations. This is actually a repeat of the webinar given on March 19th of this year. Brian will go over the basics of the ANPR. He'll talk about what the standards cover now and how the standards came to be, and explain why we're considering if it is time to revise them. So Brian will also talk about the specific type of input and information we would like to get from you during the public comment period, which is open at this time. I want you to know that EPA is not proposing any changes to the standard this time. We've issued the ANPR to solicit public input and information early as we evaluate whether the standards need to be changed at all. We are giving this presentation to provide information to help you submit comments. This webinar is not a means of submitting comments. I want to make that very clear. This is not a means of submitting comments. So comments on the ANPR must be submitted in writing. And to give you more time to write up your comments, we've actually extended the deadline. So comments are now due on August 3rd of 2014. Next slide. So we have a lot of people on the line today, so we're going to keep all the phone lines on mute. So if you can please mute your own phone line, that would be great. That way everybody can hear the presentation without distractions. And Brian will answer questions at the end of the presentation. But we will be taking questions in writing throughout the presentation. So for those of you who are participating via the webinar, you please enter your questions into the chat room. For those of you participating by phone only, please email your questions to my colleague, Tony Neske. You can email him at neske.tony@epa.gov. That is neske.tony@epa.gov. So even though we're answering questions at the end of the presentation, please feel free to enter your questions throughout the webinar. We only ask that any questions or remarks entered into the chat room be pertinent to the specific environmental regulations we are discussing today, and that they be courteous, of course. Now, we'll not allow any entries that use inappropriate language or that endorse particular services or products, and I'm sure that you all know that. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Brian. So Brian, please take us away.
Thank you, Jessica. Good afternoon to everybody, and good morning to those that are out a little further towards the West Coast. My name is Brian Littleton, and this webinar is on the Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking for Revising the Environmental Radiation Protection Standards for Nuclear Power Operations, also known as 40 CFR Part 190. We're giving this presentation to help you submit your comments. We'll talk to you about what the standards cover now, give you some background on how the standards came to be, and explain why we're considering if it is time to revise them. We'll also talk to you about some specific questions that we'd like to get input from you on. Now, if we go to the fourth slide, again, the presentation outline is here. The webinar will provide you with some basic information on the agency's existing requirements for protecting the public from radiation exposure resulting from nuclear power operations. We'll then talk to you about the EPA's development of this Advance Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, talk to you about some of the issues that the agency has highlighted for public comment, and then I'll kind of summarize what we've said. And then we'll talk about, we'll take questions from the public. So if we go to the next slide, which is slide number five. Before we get started, I'd like to talk to you, provide you some general information about EPA and nuclear power operations. EPA's mission is to protect human health and the environment. We establish generally applicable environmental standards to protect human health and the environment from radioactive materials. EPA does not directly oversee operations of nuclear power plants or nuclear fuel cycle facilities, and we are neither a proponent nor an opponent of nuclear energy. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has regulatory responsibility for licensing and operation of nuclear power plants and other commercial facilities that use radioactive materials. NRC uses EPA standards in its regulation of these nuclear power facilities. With that said, I'd like to get started with the presentation. If we could flip to slide number 6. As we start, this first slide starts giving us some background about the advance notice of proposed rulemaking. Why issue an advance notice of proposed rulemaking? EPA is reviewing its standards for nuclear power operations to determine whether revisions are necessary. We are issuing an ANPR to get public input and information on a number of specific questions. We are not currently proposing any changes to the standards, but we want to give public information and input early in the regulatory process. Slide number 7 starts talking a little bit more about the background here. So what does 40 CFR 190 and what does it cover? The Environmental Radiation Protection Standards for Nuclear Power Operations, also known as 40 CFR 190, establishes environmental radiation protection standards for nuclear power plant operations. Nuclear power operations are those facilities that are involved in the production of electricity from nuclear energy. The uranium fuel cycle includes uranium milling facilities, uranium conversion facilities, uranium enrichment facilities, fuel fabrication facilities, and nuclear power plants, and potentially any reprocessing facilities associated with electricity production. One important aspect of this regulation is that it applies to the normal operations of these facilities. It does not apply to emergency conditions. The environmental standards limit the radiation releases and public doses to the public from normal operations. These standards apply outside of the facility boundaries. This rule does not cover worker safety, which is addressed in OSHA and NRC regulations. Slide number 8, why look at the regulation now? Well, the final rule was published on January 13th of 1977, and it has not been revised since. When we first started looking at 40 CFR Part 190 several years ago, there was talk of a nuclear renaissance and a large increase in U.S. power plants. New nuclear facilities have been built and or are under construction in the U.S. However, with the Fukushima Japan nuclear accident and low natural gas prices, the nuclear power industry has waned. But nuclear power is still in the discussion for the future. Lastly, at the same time that the agency is reviewing its regulation for 40 CFR Part 190, the NRC is also reviewing some of their complementary regulations to determine if they need updating as well. Those would be the revisions to 10 CFR Part 20. Now, if we go to slide number 9, when we first started reviewing this regulation, several important issues stood out to us. These issues are listed on the slide there. The first is advances in radiation risk and dosimetry science, enforcement issues, protection of surface and groundwater, on-site storage of spent nuclear fuel, and new nuclear technologies. I'll go over each of these issues in more detail later in this presentation. Slide number 10. Now let's go a little bit deeper into the...
Brian, let me interrupt you just for a second. I just want to make sure that everybody please put their phone on mute. That way everybody can hear. Thank you. Thanks. Back over to you, Brian.
Okay. Again, slide number 10. Now we're going to go into a little bit deeper into the requirements for the environmental protection standards from nuclear power operations. 40 CFR 190 contains two main radiation provisions. First, there are public dose limits established under 40 CFR Part 190.10A. That state that no individual of the public shall receive a radiation dose in excess of 25 millirems per year to the whole body, 75 millirems per year to the thyroid, and 25 millirems per year to any other organ. To be clear, these limits are for members of the public and are not applied to radiation workers who are subject to different standards specific to them, as mentioned earlier. The limits in part 190 were based on recommendations established by the International Committee on Radiation Protection Report Number 2, or ICRP Report Number 2, that was published in 1959. And as I said before, our understanding of radiation and its effects on our bodies have improved since then. And I'll go over this in a little bit more detail in a later slide. The other major provision that's part of 40 CFR 190 is that there are radionuclide release limits established under 40 CFR 190.10b that set annual limits on the total quantity of radioactivity entering the environment for certain radionuclides per a gigawatt of electricity produced. These limits are 50,000 curies of krypton 85, 5 millicuries of iodine 129, and 0.5 or half a millicurie of combined plutonium 239 and other alpha emitters with half lives exceeding one year. We need to note that some of these limits were developed with a focus on reprocessing or processing of spent nuclear fuel. This is because krypton 85 and iodine 129 are released only as part of a fission reaction, so they only become issued after the nuclear fuel has undergone a fission reaction. Additionally, with the exception of very minor releases, the majority of these fission products remain in the spent fuel assembly and would not be released until the reprocessing step, because this is where the fuel cladding would be opened and the gases could readily escape. It is this process that could potentially release amounts of these radionuclides which could exceed these quantities in a year. It also needs to be stated that reprocessing of spent nuclear fuel has not taken place in the U.S. on a commercial scale for over 40 years. Slide number 11. Now I want to talk a little bit about our rationale for the existing standards. So what were our goals when we developed the original standard in 1977? The agency stated that the standards for the nuclear power industry should limit the total radiation dose to populations, limit the maximum dose to individuals, should consider the risk of health effects attributable to these doses, including future risk from the release of long-lived or persistent radionuclides to the environment, and lastly, should consider the effectiveness of cost of technology available to mitigate these risks through effluent control. Now, these goals have not changed. The agency is still committed to them, and they serve as a guiding beacon in determining what changes may warrant consideration for revision. Slide number 12. The next slide provides additional insight into the agency's thinking in developing the 1977 standard. These dose limits were designed to limit population and individual exposures from uranium fuel cycle facilities. They set a total dose received from the fuel cycle as a whole from all pathways. This dose is not limited just to the air pathway or the groundwater intake pathway. This dose also includes all possible exposure routes for radiation from these facilities, which means air, water, and direct exposure routes. Additionally, in developing the 1977 standards, the agency found that the most prudent basis for relating radiation dose to public health continues to be to assume a potential for health effects exists at all levels of exposure. This is also known as the linear non-threshold concept. Basically, the linear non-threshold concept, or LNT, assumes that the risk of cancer increases proportionally as exposure increases. The agency's support for the linear non-threshold concept has not changed, and this is not one of the topics that we are asking for you to comment on in this advance notice of proposed rulemaking. slide number 13. The general question that we're asking in our ANPR is how should the agency update the requirements for radiation protection from nuclear power operations? There is general consensus or support that some revisions are necessary to the existing standard. Where we get differences of opinion is on the issue of what specific provisions should be updated in any proposal. In addition to the general question, we've outlined six specific issues that we are requesting public comment on. I've already briefly addressed these issues generally, and we'll talk about each of these issues in the following slides. I think that previous slide was misnumbered as slide number 14. It was slide number 13. This one is slide number 14. Issue one, should the agency use radiation risk or dose in the regulation? For this issue, the main question that the issue is putting is, should we consider risk or dose? Dose has traditionally been used for developing radiation protection standards to either workers or the public. Dose is generally measured by either sampling the media, meaning a water sample or an air sample, performing chemical tests to identify what radioactive contaminant is present, and then performing a radioactive count to determine the concentration of the radioactive component. Additionally, direct radiation is determined by either knowing the radiation source and the distance a person is from the source and estimating the direct radiation dose, or by placing a personal radiation detector on the person and measuring the absorbed radiation over a set period of time. However, risk could also be used. The agency uses risk to determine acceptable limits of public protection and has set acceptable protection goals as in the range of from one excess cancer per 10,000 persons to one excess cancer per 1 million persons. We could specify an acceptable risk range in the standards. There are some that believe that the risk would be could be a more direct measure of an acceptable level of radiation. However, there are challenges in determining what would have to be done to comply with this. Slide number 15. So on this issue, we are looking for specific input from the public on the advantages and disadvantages of a risk standard and your input upon what it would take to comply with one. Specifically, should the agency express its limit for the purpose of this regulation in terms of radiation risk or radiation dose? Should the agency base any risk standard on cancer morbidity or cancer mortality? What would be the advantages or disadvantages of each? And how might implementation of a risk standard be carried out? How might a risk standard affect other federal regulations and or guidance? Lastly, what are the cost considerations of moving to a risk standard? So these are the issues we'd like to hear from the public on this issue. Slide number 16. The next slide talks about updating the dose methodology. In general, the question that the agency is requesting comment on is, if the agency continues to use a dose limit, how should the agency update radiation dosimetry methodology incorporated in the standard? The existing standard is based on a dose methodology that was established in 1959. This is the Oregon-specific dosimetry published in the ICRP report number 2. We've come a long way in our understanding of radiation and radiation dose and its impact on the human body. To be specific, the scientific community, in the scientific community, the critical Oregon concept has been abandoned for the effective dose equivalent concept, or better known as the effective dose. Effective dose uses the weighted sum of the doses to individual organs of the body. There's consensus among radiation protection scientists that effective dose more accurately represents risk than the current limits for specific organs and whole body dose. In the mid-1980s, the EPA's Science Advisory Board recommended that EPA use the effective dose approach, and EPA has followed that advice, beginning with the development of the Radiation Hazardous Air Pollutant Regulations, which were started to be published in 1989. More recently, updated dosimetry is now available, allowing the calculation of effective dose to subpopulations. And by subpopulations, an example of that would be children. This methodology, or younger individuals. This methodology was established in ICRP report number 103. There are some policy issues associated with this capability, which we won't go into in this general presentation. But suffice it to say that our understanding of radiation protection is much improved over what it was in 1977. Finally, revised risk estimates are now available, which provide the most recent peer-reviewed and agreed-upon risk that exposure to different radionuclides pose. This information is available in the agency's EPA's Radiogenic Cancer Risk Models and Projections Handbook, or as it is otherwise known as the Blue Book. So for this issue, if we stay with the use of dose as the basis for the regulation, the questions that we are asking input from the public on are, if a dose standard is desired, how should the agency take account of updated scientific information and methods related to radiation dose, such as the concept of a committed effective dose? And secondly, in updating the dose standard, should the methodology in ICRP 60 or ICRP 103 be adopted, or should implementation allow some flexibility to the implementing agency, which would be NRC? What are the relative advantages or disadvantages of not specifying which ICRP method be used for the dose assessment? Okay. So now I'd like to move on to slide number 18, which is the third issue, the radionuclide release limits. The next slide talks about the third issue being brought up in the ANPR, that being the radionuclide release limits for certain radionuclides established under 40 CFR Part 190.10B. This issue is somewhat complex, but for the purposes of this general webinar, the question we are asking is, should the agency retain radionuclide release limits in an updated rule? And if so, what should the agency use as the basis for any release limits? As I mentioned earlier in this webinar, there are specific limits established for krypton, iodine, plutonium, and other alpha emitters. These regulatory limits were established to limit certain radionuclides that were either very long-lived or very non-reactive in the environment and would remain in the environment in a dangerous form. This small list of radionuclides was generated by considering those radionuclides that were either produced as a product or byproduct of the production of nuclear energy, or were concentrated or mobilized by human efforts to generate nuclear energy. There are implementation concerns with enforcing any potential noncompliance. The standard applies collectively as a total of all emissions from all uranium fuel cycle facilities for the nation. So if a national nuclear energy balance is conducted for any 1 year, and we divide the total quantity of any of these specific radionuclides by the amount of nuclear energy produced, and we find there is exceedance of one of the radionuclide limits, then which facility do we require reductions on in the amount of that radionuclide being emitted from their facility? Which facility do we impose a penalty on? For these reasons, the agency believes that these limits should be reconsidered. Slide number 19. For this issue, the agency is looking for input on, should the agency retain the concept of radionuclide-specific release limits to prevent environmental buildup of long-lived radionuclides? What should be the basis of these limits? Secondly, is it justifiable to apply limits on an industry-wide basis? And if so, can this be reasonably implemented? Would facility limits be more practicable? And lastly, if release limits are used, are the radionuclides for which limits have been established in the existing standards still appropriate? And if not, which ones should be added or subtracted? Slide number 20. This next slide talks about the fourth issue brought up in the ANPR, water resource protection. In general, we're asking, how should a revised rule protect water resources? Well, groundwater and surface water are valuable resources necessary to maintain human life and healthy ecosystems. When the existing rule was developed in 1977, environmental contamination through the water pathway was not believed to be a major contributor to environmental contamination from nuclear facilities. Most contamination was believed to occur through air emissions and subsequent deposition in the environment. However, experience has indicated that the likelihood of groundwater contamination is much greater than previously believed. At nuclear power plants, tritium has leaked into the groundwater at several facilities. While much of the contamination remains on the facility site and below the agency's maximum contaminant levels, or MCLs, for the drinking water concentrations, the initial assumption that the groundwater and surface water pathways would not be major contributors for public exposure to radiation from these facilities appears to be incorrect. In addition to finding groundwater contamination in the vicinity of several nuclear power plants, radioactive contaminants, meaning uranium, strontium, cesium, have been found in groundwater near other uranium fuel cycle facilities. These environmental problems could linger on long past the operational phase of these facilities.
I was just going to remind people that if they have questions on any of the content that's happened so far, you can feel free to put it into the chat box on the webinar, or if you're just on the teleconference, you can email my colleague Tony Neske at neske.tony@epa.gov. That's neske.tony@epa.gov. Thanks. Keep going, Brian.
Okay. The nuclear industry has instituted a number of voluntary steps to help these facilities detect and control groundwater contamination before it becomes a problem. Still, the agency wants input into whether additional controls are necessary and what issues may arise in the implementation of any controls. So now if we go on to the agency would like your input on these questions. If a groundwater protection standard is established in the general environment outside the boundaries of nuclear fuel cycle facilities, what should the basis be and how should it be implemented? And secondly, are additional standards aimed at limiting surface water contamination needed? Slide number 22. The next slide discusses the issue of spent nuclear fuel storage. For this issue, the agency is asking how, if at all, should a revised rule explicitly address storage of spent nuclear fuel? When the existing rule was issued, storage of spent radioactive materials at nuclear fuel cycle facilities was not explicitly identified as an activity covered by the standards. Specifically, it was envisioned that spent nuclear fuel would be stored in a spent fuel pool for 18 months, then move from the nuclear power plant to a reprocessing plant or to a disposal facility where the radioactive emissions will be limited by a separate set of disposal requirements established for the disposal facility. However, no permanent disposal site for spent nuclear fuel has been agreed upon yet, and the spent nuclear fuel has been stored at the nuclear power plants in dry cask storage containers or in the spent fuel pools in much greater quantities than originally envisioned. Since these wastes are stored for much longer durations, there's a possibility that these wastes could contribute to higher public doses. Additionally, since operating practices have changed drastically from what was envisioned, the applicability of standards with respect to the environmental radiations for management and storage of spent fuel, and these regulations are found in 40 CFR Part 191, may not be clear and may need clarification. The agency believes that storage of a covered activity, that storage is a covered activity, I'm sorry for that, but if we revise 190, it may be prudent to explicitly state that the rule is applicable to long-term storage at these sites. One change could be as simple as changing the statement of applicability in the definition. Slide number 23. The agency would like your input on how, if at all, should a revised rule explicitly address on-site storage operations for spent nuclear fuel? And secondly, is it necessary to clarify the applicability of 40 CFR Part 190 versus 40 CFR Part 191 to storage operations? Should the agency clarify the scope of 40 CFR Part 190 to also cover operations as separate facilities off-site dedicated to storage of spent nuclear fuel? Slide number 24. The last issue that the agency that is discussed in the ANPR has to do with the issue of new nuclear technologies. The agency is asking whether new nuclear technologies and practices have developed since the 1977 rule was issued, and how should any revised rule address these advances and changes. The existing rule sets limits that apply to the uranium fuel cycle, but other nuclear energy fuel cycles exist. At the time of the development of the existing standard, many of the concepts existed in their earlier forms. However, the agency chose to develop standards for only the uranium fuel cycle as they determined that this was the most likely direction that nuclear power would take in the United States. As it stands today, this is the case. However, we do see other nations pursuing alternate forms of nuclear energy, specifically the thorium fuel cycle. And there would be some in the U.S. that argue that we need to pursue other alternatives to light water reactors that form the basis of today's U.S. nuclear energy supply. One new technology that the public may have heard a lot about lately are the small modular reactors. What are these reactors? Generally, they are smaller versions of existing nuclear reactor designs that lessen the impacts of criticality if this were to occur. Do small modular reactors pose unique environmental considerations, or do existing limits adequately address concerns with small modular reactors? The ANPR tries to provide some context so that the public can weigh in on this issue. Of the other alternate nuclear technologies, how close are these new technologies to feasible implementation, and what are they? The ANPR attempts to summarize the current state of these new nuclear technologies for the public in order to provide them the context so that they can weigh in on this issue as well. So for this issue, the agency is requesting comments on: are there specific new nuclear technologies or practices with unique characteristics that would dictate the need for separate or different limits, and do these differences merit a reconsideration of the technical basis for 40 CFR Part 190? Secondly, should the agency develop standards that will proactively apply to new nuclear technologies developed in the future, and if so, how far into the future should the agency look? And then lastly, in particular, do small modular reactors pose unique environmental concerns that warrant separate standards within 40 CFR Part 190? Slide number 26. In summary, EPA is considering reviewing and revising its environmental protection requirements to nuclear power operations, or 40 CFR Part 190. We have published this ANPR in order to solicit information and comments on the six specific issues that we covered today. The ANPR provides background on these topics and our general understanding and views on the topics. We have asked for public input very early in our regulatory process, and we have not made any decisions or determined any specifics on how to move forward for any of these issues. We do, however, believe that the regulation uses outdated science, and we are thinking about how to bring the regulation more in line with current thinking. We'll look forward to your comments to help us determine the path forward on these issues. In addition to the six specific issues that we have requested comment on, the agency will also take comment on other facets of this standard. Now, the last two slides talk about public outreach and input. We are holding what was previously a 120-day comment period. We have extended that comment period. I believe Jessica mentioned this early at the beginning of this, but we have extended the comment period, and it now closes on August 3rd of this year. So it's a 180-day comment period. For specific information about this webinar, as well as other specific webinars that we have developed some webinars for, you can go to our website at www.epa.gov/radiation/laws/190. And lastly, we're providing this information to you so that you know how to make comments on our ANPR. Comments can be submitted by going to the regulations.gov website at www.regulations.gov and following the directions there, or by submitting comments via email to a-an-r.docket@epa.gov, or you can send them send mail directly to the EPA Docket Center, care of Environmental Radiation Protection Standards for Nuclear Power Operations, or you can hand deliver these comments to our EPA Docket Center at 1301 Constitution Avenue in Northwest Washington, D.C., during normal work hours. All these are covered on the website. All these ways of providing comments are covered on the website. Now we'd like to take any questions from the public.
So at this point, we don't have any questions in the chat box. And moving the mic over. At this point, we don't have any questions in the chat box, so please, now is a good time to enter questions into the chat box if you have any. And if you're on the teleconference and don't have access to the webinar, you can still email questions to my colleague, Tony Neske. Again, it's Neske, N as in Nancy, ESKY.Tony, TONY, @epa.gov. We have a question saying, will the slides be available on the website?
They are.
They already are. So, yes, they are absolutely available on the website.
And the other part of that is that we are recording this presentation, and we're going to make the presentation, the audio of this presentation available on the website as well.
For those of you who missed it, I'm going to retype the URL in for you into the chat box. We're going to stay on the line for another 5 minutes, so if you would like to enter your questions in, feel free, we'll be here. And for those of you who are going to leave us, thank you so much for joining us. But we will stay on for another 5 minutes.
I guess as we kind of close out this webinar, what I do want to say is that what the agency is going to do is going to be to provide kind of a summary of the questions that were asked during each of the webinars, and we'll be providing that. It will take us a little bit of time to get that up on the website, but we will be putting that up on the website as well. So that will be available as kind of a summary of what we've heard from the public during our each of the webinars.
We have a question. Does EK publish all comments submitted, not just what is discussed in the webinar?
All the comments that are submitted are going to be available on our website, on the www.regulations.gov website. As of this morning, there were 31 comments that had been submitted, and those are all available for anyone to see. So we are publishing all the comments unless, you know, barring minor things such as the profanity and
language
and, you know, those minor details. We will be publishing those comments, and they're going to be on the website.
We have a comment. The federal regulatory agencies, EPA and NRC, should exercise consistency in the use and implementation of the ICRP methodology. Thank you for that. In order for us to actually consider it as part of the actual review, please enter that comment and any other comments that you have into our docket. This is not a way to enter comments into the docket for consideration, but thank you for that. I think that's certainly worth considering.
Yes, thank you for the comment. I guess when the commenter does submit that comment to the agency, they might want to be a little bit more specific upon, I guess, what aspects of the ICRP methodology that they feel that there are problems or could be problems with. That could be helpful for us as well.
When Brian was saying that we're going to capture what we've seen on the webinars, that's not going to be going into the docket. Really, it's going to be kind of an FAQ, frequently asked questions of the types of things we've heard so that we can provide some clarification. We're going to hang on just another minute or two, and then we're going to sign off. But I do want to thank you all for joining us today, and I hope you found this useful and informative, and thank Brian very much for his presentation. And we look forward to seeing your comments in the docket. Have a wonderful, wonderful afternoon. right, guys, we're going to sign off. Have a wonderful afternoon, and like I said, look forward to seeing your comments in the docket. Bye.
Star two.
You sound so confident.